Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Space Junk. It's time once again to talk about all things amateur astronomy. And today we are going to really geek out pretty hard on astrophotography, because today we have with us is Rogelio Bernal Andreo. He is our guest today. And if you care about astrophotography, then you're going to want to listen to this episode, because this guy is amazing. And we're going to learn all about how he does his astrophotography, hopefully get some tips and techniques from him, and just geek out here on taking pictures of the night sky. But before I get started, I need to say, first of all, that I'm Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space, and with me is Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes. Are you out there, Dustin?
Hey, Tony, this is really, really exciting for me. I've been looking up to Rogelio for so long. His imaging is, arguably the best in the world. And, it appears everywhere, and we're going to get into that. But first, Rogelio, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It is so good to finally be talking to you. I'm going to just mention to our listeners, as you're going along with this podcast, if you happen to be at your laptop, please go to deepskycolors.com and check out some of these images, because you'll get a sense of what we're talking about. We're not a visual medium, so we can't show you the images, but follow along if you can, or at least when you get to a spot when you can, look his name up and you will see some amazing images.
Yeah, it definitely sets the bar. You know, I go there every now and then just to kind of see, like, all right, am I progressing or whatever? And then I see these images and I'm just like, oh God, I have so far to go. So let's dive in. I have probably 10,000 questions for you, Rogelio.
Okay.
Okay. He sounds a little bit scared.
He's like, okay. This is gonna be more than an hour.
I didn't study for this.
So first, I gotta ask the basic question, which is, how did you get into this?
Astrophotography. Well, I say that we all have these moments, right? Where from not being interested at all on something to be interested and maybe embrace it fully. And so I had this moment with astrophotography. That was September 2007. Of course, I remember it very clearly. I was driving with my family down the Pacific Coast Highway, south of Big Sur. And then my wife opened the moonroof of the car. She looked up, see all these stars. And then she's like, oh, you got to pull over. You have to see this. So I pulled over. I mean, we were driving. It was at night, so I couldn't see a thing with the lights of the car. So I get out of there, and there I was seeing the Milky Way for the very first time in my entire life. I was 35 years old, married with two kids. So I was like, what is this, right? And I happened to have a camera. It was one of these cameras that you would bring, to take pictures with your family and stuff. And I'm like, can I take a picture of this? It was one of the first things that occurred to me. I had never done any kind of photography other than family type of pictures. So I take the camera and I'm like, okay, so how do I focus, right? How can I focus? I had no idea how to do anything, but don't ask me how. I knew I had to take a longer exposure. That's the only thing that I knew. It had to be different. So somehow I managed to take a shot of the Milky Way. And then when I saw it popping on the screen on the camera, much more vivid than in my eyes, I was like, oh, wow. So that kind of got me intrigued. And I'm like, can a regular person like myself take, these pictures that I've seen sometimes, of galaxies and nebulas? So I got very curious about it. And then the next time that when we got back home, got on the internet, started do searches, and then, that just did it for me.
Yeah, it's amazing how that works, right? Because mine was similar. It was started with the Milky Way, and you see that first picture pop up. And to people that haven't shot it, it's really hard to explain because it really is something that gives you a brand new perspective when you see the Milky Way for the first time, kind of like you're talking about. You know, you get out of your car, and then at first I thought it was a cloud going overhead. Right. You know, when you see this, it's so bright and just dense, and that density really gives you perspective. And then when you take a photo and you can see it clearly, kind of like what you see in pictures, you know, even the unedited just on the back of the camera will blow you away. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's, for me, it was, you know, a life-changing moment. Obviously I changed my entire career path and everything. And it's been something now, if it's clear, I'm, you know, outside imaging. And, and it's been that way since, you know, really that first photo. And it sounds like, you know, you've been along for the same kind of ride.
Pretty much the same thing, yeah. And I got, well, some people say I got obsessed with it. I call it a passion, right?
Yeah. It's good to use the euphemisms.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, especially when there's money being spent involved, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have... You've really, I mean, obviously from jumping out of a car and taking a photo of the Milky Way to producing images that now, I mean, there aren't many people that haven't seen your images, even if they don't know it. You know, it's all over television. It's, I mean, you have something like, you have over 50 APODs from NASA, don't you?
Something like that, yeah.
And that's for people that don't know, that's about the most prestigious award you're going to get in astrophotography. It's saying that you have the best image in the world that day, being awarded by the APOD group, you know, part of which is NASA. And yeah, most people, if they get one, they celebrate it forever.
It's true. Let me just say that for those of you who don't know what that is, APOD is Astronomy Picture of the Day. And it's been around, as far as I know, since the early 2000s, probably before that.
And actually, 1995. That's when it started.
Oh, it started in 95. And if you go to the APOD page, you'll notice that it looks exactly like a mid-90s web page. They just haven't done anything with it as far as making this web page itself all that fancy. But that's fine because you're so busy looking at the image itself. I think that's actually a good thing. It's a feature because you're more concentrating on the image that's being highlighted that day than you are the webpage itself.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, these images have to be flawless. They have to be fantastic to get an APOD award. And, you know, you have over 50 of these. It's almost funny, man. It really is. It's just... It's so incredible. And, you know, we have your images popping up here all the time just because a lot of our customers use them for reference. They see these images and then they come to us and say, you know, I want to shoot something like this. Mm-hmm. And obviously in the back of our heads, we're thinking, shit, so do we, you know, but, you know, it's it gives people kind of a target, I think, to kind of aspire to. But it hasn't been that long since you got started. I would have assumed you've been doing this much, much longer than what you're saying. You're saying you started in, what, 2007?
Yeah, September 2007 was when I had that, you know, that moment with the Milky Way. So I really got started when I started to, when I convinced my wife that I needed to buy some equipment to do these pictures, which took a while. Then I really started doing astrophotography early 2008. That's when I started. But this is what happened. So when I started, of course, first you need to learn all the tricks, to learn the craft and the equipment and how to take the pictures and then the processing. And I had that period. I can tell you that for more than a year, I was taking pictures that you probably wouldn't pay any attention to. Most people haven't seen those pictures, but those who were along with me at the time that they did it and had this my own learning curve. Actually, one thing that you may find interesting is that when I finally managed to take my first deep sky picture, which was, of course, Orion, it had to be either Orion, Andromeda, or the Pleiades, one of those, right?
Yeah.
So it was Orion, and most people get excited, but I was extremely disappointed because it was, of course, I don't remember, but maybe 3, 4, 5 shots with a DSLR and some cheap telescope. And didn't even know how to really stack. So, you know, my results were really poor. And I'm like, so what kind of crap is this? This is not what I want to do. So I don't know if that actually was something, you know, that triggered me to keep trying. But yeah, I certainly had that learning period where, you know, you try and you fail and so on.
Why was your first image disappointing? Why did you not like it? What was wrong with it?
Mostly very noisy, extremely noisy. As I stretched, you know, stretching meaning, you know, make the image brighter, as you may know. The image to see what's in there, everything was so noisy. There were no details, so it didn't look like anything that I thought it would look like. To me, it was, you know, I was expecting to see something prettier, I guess. And I would say I got something, and that was it. Mostly the noise, and the fact that I saw something. Oh, I got something, but it just didn't look like anything that I wanted it to look like, I guess. And then I started to apply heavy noise reduction, which is what every beginner does, right? Mm-hmm. To make it all super soft. But I wasn't happy about that either. So, but that got me to go back onto the internet and start asking questions. Hey, what's this and how can I make it better? And you know, and people started answering questions. And so I started learning little by little. And like I said, I spent a good year and a half mostly learning.
Well, can I ask you guys, this is a question for both of you, and the Orion Nebula is a good example while we're talking about it. I've imaged it many times, and I know just what you mean about being disappointed by the results. And part of the problem, for those of us who are trying to image Orion, one of the things you'll run across is that it's got a lot of very bright things in it next to a lot of very dim things. For example, the trapezium in the center almost always gets saturated in an exposure that you take, especially if you want to see the nebulosity around the area. What do you guys have any tricks for fixing that? Do you like take any a combination of exposures? How do you end up with an image that isn't saturating the stars, but still bringing out the nebulosity on the outside?
Well, so when I go ahead, Dustin.
No, I was going to say, you're going to talk about HDR. You want to explain it or you want me to?
I'll go ahead.
What's HDR, first of all?
Go for it.
So my answer to your question, Tony, is that, which is what, you know, Dustin was about to mention, you do take two different exposures. One meaning, and in the case of Orion, maybe just like 15-second exposure. And you take several of those, but you don't go above 15 seconds, maybe 20, 30 seconds, depending on the sensitivity of your camera, your aperture, and so on. And then you combine that with a stack of longer exposures, whether that's 5-minute subs or 10 minutes or whatever you want to shoot. And then you combine those in an HDR kind of fashion. HDR is a process that, in theory, basically, it compresses the dynamic range that you have. So really bright things can be a little darker, so you can see better what's in there, and vice versa for the really dark areas. So for Orion, for the Orion Nebula in particular, you have that area that you mentioned around the trapezium, where basically you will blend your 15-20 second exposures of that area with the rest of the image.
But right. You still have the underlying saturated images, don't you? You can't just co-add them,
yeah.
Right?
Well, yes, some software can, but HDR stands for high dynamic range. And I mean, it's really an illusion created by doing exactly what he's talking about there, you know, taking two exposures that each is highlighting the portion that you want to. And then when you combine those, obviously you leave out the parts that are blown out or completely underexposed. And then it kind of gives you that, you know, that compression that he's talking about, to where, you know, you have this illusion that the sensor has much better dynamic range than it actually does.
So does the software handle that, and I don't have to worry about it then, or do you have to somehow know how to, you know, scale these images such that the really bright star ones don't get added as much as the fainter starred ones?
Well, you have two options. One is there's software that's going to do this for you automatically. You say, this is my long exposure master light, and this is my shorter exposure. And then you throw those onto the tool, and then the tool does it, and then it looks fantastic, or not, depending on, you know, how the results come out.
Yeah.
And you could also do it manually in a different number of ways as well. So it's entirely up to you. But there's definitely tools out there that can do it for you.
Well, give us some idea. So I'm being the audience advocate here because I want to help people who are listening thinking, I want to do this too. What kind of tools would you recommend for this kind of co-adding?
Well, for HDR blending of deep sky images, what I personally use is PixInsight. I use that for a lot of other things as well. And that's what I would recommend. Several years ago, I did a comparison that I will need to look up actually to remember, that actually compared different HDR tools with an image of M42, the Orion Nebula. But these were the tools at the time, and this tutorial I wrote it maybe 8 years ago. So there's even more and better tools right now. So I won't say PixInsight is the best one for the job, but it definitely does a really good job in doing automatically.
The
HDR process. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and a lot more. PixInsight is that's what I use as well. It's an incredibly powerful astro imaging editing tool. It can do the majority of what you're going to do to an astro image.
Right. Now the file format, and we promise we're going to geek out here, folks. So so the file format that most cameras put out, is it still FITS images in the newer cameras?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So do all of these software packages read the FITS images in?
Yes. I mean, if it's a image editing software specific for astrophotography, if they don't handle FITS, it's like not handling JPEG for the web. They all do, yeah.
So I just want to mention to people that the FITS is a flexible image transport system, and it was developed by NASA and it is the main astronomical data format for all images, even Hubble. Every single thing that NASA runs, takes images in FITS format to later be either used for processing pretty pictures or for calibrating scientific data. And the reason is that each one of the pixels in a FITS image can be assigned a unit in terms of it can have a scientific unit, not just a count like you would get from a lot of CCDs. Instead of having a number there like 32,000, they could have a number in there that might be 5,400 after calibration, and that 5,400 would be in a unit of, say, flux or ergs or something like that. So it's a very valuable image format system, and these programs read it in, and that's what they start with because that's what comes off the camera.
So the thing with the FITS is that, as you said, is suitable for scientific data as opposed to just, pixel data images. But one thing that it comes handy for us is because really what we're collecting are pixels in our case. One thing that comes handy for us with the FITS is that they have some metadata, and that is actually useful for a number of things that we're going to do later with the images. Like it normally may store the temperature of the CCD camera, temperature regulated camera that we use at the time of taking the picture. Also maybe the coordinates where we were pointing at, and other information that is valuable for us later when we do things like calibration and registration and these kind of things with the images. So that comes handy. That's something that other formats don't offer.
Right, and that's in that's in the header unit. There's every single FITS image has two parts: a header. It's called a header data unit, and it's got a header in it, and it's got the data. The header has all this text information in it. What kind of camera? Where were you? Is this a calibration image? Is this a data image? You can put anything you want in that header. And then it's followed by the data layer, which is the actual image itself. That's the pixel data. And you can stack as many of those HDUs in an image as you want. And those are called data cubes. And these can be huge, huge images if you want them to be. So Yes. So that's your introduction into Fitz Data. If you don't know about it, then look it up, because that is what the cameras are going to be putting out.
I knew that we were going to go down some of these rabbit holes today. And, you know,
I'm just following.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask you something, because I take a very different approach to this. Very different. I think that you and I are probably on opposite ends of the spectrum, Rogelio. Okay. You know, you are putting out some of the best work in the world. And when, you know, it's flawless imaging in a lot of ways. My images are, if you blow them up bigger than about an inch by an inch, like, you know, they start to come apart, because they're really the only place they're going to work is on Instagram. And they're edited mostly on a cell phone. And it's really about simplifying the process and trying to make it as accessible as possible to as many people as possible to get started. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know what you think about that, because when someone goes to your page, one of the first things they're going to find when they're reading about you is, you know, you went to Harvard and a few other places, you know, you studied computer science, and this is very complex stuff that you're doing. Even what you guys are talking about now. I mean, for most people, I think that's going to be intimidating to think like, oh, that sounds like a hobby. That's just a ton of work, you know? And so I want to know your thoughts. Do you think that people have to have a path like that? Or do you think this is something anyone can do?
I can answer that in two ways. One is from my own experience, and the other one from what I've seen others doing, right? In my own experience, as you said, I did, I studied computer science. And not only that, but while I was doing computer science, I was very much attracted to anything related to graphics. And this is from the very beginning, you know, the early 90s. That's when I was going to college, from 1990 to 1995. At the time I was writing silly games where I had to create the graphics for the game. So I was always involved with colors and tools to create graphics. Back then were extremely simple, you know, pixel level type of simple graphics. But that got me used to an environment that perhaps for somebody who's never done it, and say I want to do astro photography, and then, you know, it's a whole new world for them in front of them, not just, you know, a whole of different new worlds. So I guess that helped me for my entire time in college and afterward, there's always been some sort of graphic application, you know, installed on my computer, whether, you know, back in the days was PaintShop Pro, CorelDRAW, and then, of course, Photoshop and whatnot. So, when it came my time to, I'm capturing, you know, data from a galaxy or a nebula, I need to edit, I need to do stuff with this. I wasn't intimidated by what's this software? So for me, that was, I guess, easy to get, you know, start from there, as opposed to from the very beginning. But at the same time, I'll tell you, I've seen people, within a year or two, from not having this background at all, just using computers, you know, nowadays, like, you know, most people use for, you know, surfing the web and whatnot, and get intrigued by astrophotography and embrace it and you know, go really crazy, kind of like what I did back in the days. And within a couple of years, you know, they're really producing really, really, really great stuff. So I wouldn't say it's a requirement. I think it helped me maybe get onto, you know, getting better results faster. But again, I've seen some people who I don't know if they're born with it or whatever, but so I don't see that as a requirement as well. So I guess you can have both. But if you have some experience, that's going to help you, of course.
Yeah, you know, I would agree. I've seen people, and it's funny because it's people with technical backgrounds that I've seen do extremely well with astrophotography. And then the other extreme is true artists, like people that paint. Or people that just spend a ton of time doing graphic design or something like that, you know, once they collect the data, what they do with it is absolutely incredible. And it really can go, you know, it can go really well with either side, I feel like. So it's one of the few hobbies, I feel like that's the case, that you can be completely different types of people and still produce phenomenal results.
It definitely has, and I'm sure, you know, you must have mentioned this in other podcasts because it's a classic, and that astrophotography, it really is a blend of of art and science. In
it is
definitely a technical. You need some sort of technical background, but at the same time, you need to have something that you can, you know, bring that raw data into something that is what you wanted to create in the first place, and that's the artistic process.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that there are probably a lot of astrophotographers that look up to you and your work. Do you have astrophotographers that you look up to or that you admire their work?
Well, I mean, I like the work of many people, and probably mentioning just a few wouldn't be fair to the others. Right. But you know, taking on your question, one thing that I've been asked sometimes is, you know, is there anybody who has inspired you? And I bring it up because it's funny. It comes out as a disappointing answer because as I started doing astrophotography, I was looking at what I had available at the time, which wasn't a lot compared to today. You know, but I saw the images from Tony Hallas or Adam Block, Robert Gendler, and I liked them. But then when I started doing my photography, I wasn't looking after, I want my pictures to look like these guys or that guy or even a particular image. I just wanted to, and I don't want to say I wanted to see what I could do, even though that's true, but more kind of like, oh, there's this object here and I want to see it, perhaps in a way that I haven't seen it before. And then that's what I was going after. So do I like the work of many people? Yeah, absolutely. There's more and more people. Sure. But it's funny that at the same time, I really didn't have, a role model or someone that I want, you know, as an inspiration to produce my work. So
it's funny that you mentioned those three because, again, those are three of the best imagers in the world. And your work really doesn't resemble theirs at all. You definitely have a completely different style, I'd say, than all three of them. So that's interesting that those were the pictures that you were seeing when you were getting started.
Well, it's what it was available. I mean, there were them and you know, I could name, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7 other people, but not that many that I remember at the time, really.
How can astrophotography have a style? Aren't we all just taking pictures of the Pleiades and Orion Nebula? I mean, how can you tell one astrophotographer's image from another?
Well, that's a good question because people have said of my images that I have a style. And that happened, people told me before I realized I had a style. Which now I acknowledge because that's what people say. So it's kind of funny. There was a point in, as I was doing astrophotography again, so I had this period where, you know, you don't know what you're doing, you are learning, you're getting better and better. And when all these, you know, technical challenges were more or less under control, I got to a setup that I was more in control and then being at the mercy of whatever, you know, the equipment decides to do. Then I started to look at my, so I'm thinking, what am I going to take a picture of next? And rather than just an object, I wanted a view. And with the view, once I set up the view, I want to look at this. And when I say a view, I mean, I was almost deliberately, but I think it was more of a natural reaction. I was trying to stay away from taking images of X object in the middle type of photograph, which is what everybody else was doing. Not everybody, but almost everybody else was doing at the time. And, I joke, you guys were not doing astrophotography. You were building catalogs, you know.
So composition then is
exactly.
Part of it.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. I started to look for views like and always trying, not always, but most of the time, trying to combine more than one object or two and looking at it more on a, you know, like a landscape type of photography. You know, so this object's here and that object's here, so I could frame them like these and it will look good.
Oh, I am so glad you brought up the landscapes, because I am looking at your Flickr feed. Sorry. And this is on Flickr, guys. So it's Deep Sky Colors as usual. And oh, my God, these are beautiful photos. I mean, these landscapes are unbelievable. I mean, and I love the tropical islands in the foreground. And then you've got the just rich night sky behind it. Talk about those a little bit. How do you take those?
Okay, so yeah, I've done a lot of those, mostly because they are much faster than produced.
Are they? Oh, wow. That's not an answer I expected to hear.
When I say faster, yeah, maybe I should clarify. I mean, a single picture in some remote area in the middle of Death Valley, it's not a 20-second thing. Obviously, you need to go to the place, the right time and so on. So oftentimes it takes planning and a lot of effort and time. But anyway, let me start from the beginning and we'll get to that. So I was doing a lot of deep sky photography, and then at some point, while you're doing deep sky photography, you are sitting there next to your equipment doing nothing. So one of the things that I started doing to kill time was, took my DSLR camera and a tripod and started taking pictures, maybe of my equipment with a Milky Way on the back or whatever I had around me. Except that usually where I go to do deep sky photography doesn't have like really beautiful landscapes. You basically want low horizons, that type of thing. So, but then I started to like also taking this little, wide field landscape, night landscape photography, photographs. And then I realized, where do I live? I'm here in Northern California. I have some of the most amazing landscapes in the world, within hour's reach. So one night I said, I'm going to go a couple of nights to Yosemite and just shoot away whatever I found. I had never been to Yosemite before, even though I've been living in California for over 20 years. And this was like 7 years ago or so. So I went on to that night, and then I went to all the, iconic locations and shot here, shot there. So in one night, I came out with maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 different shots. And this goes back to your question, why so many in compared to Deep Sky? Because, for example, my mosaic of the Orion constellation, that took me months to take, because that's like a huge mosaic. It's 7x7, so it's 49 different panes. To build the entire Orion, image. So that takes, many nights just for a single picture. Whereas doing night landscape photography or nightscapes, as we call them, you can do a whole bunch of them in a night or two. So I started liking it, and I started enjoying visiting all these, all these beautiful locations and, trying to capture them, however I could. So I became really prolific at that for several years, while still doing some deep sky photography at the same time.
So let's geek out on the equipment for a second. I'm an equipment junkie. And looking at your systems, the easy one to describe is probably your landscape system. Let's start there. What do you use for these landscapes?
For like night landscape photography?
Right.
From the moment I started back in 2011, 2012, I was using a Canon 5D Mark II as my DSLR camera. In fact, at some point I had two of them. When I went to Hawaii for a huge adventure, to photograph all the islands at night. Actually brought two Canon 5D Mark IIs. I have a cheap tripod. I it's somewhat sturdy. I really need to buy a better one. but I guess it does the work, right? And that's my equipment. But then about a couple of years ago, I wouldn't say I retired my Canon, but that's what the camera feels I've done with her. Because I bought the Sony A7S DSLR, which I absolutely love. I mean, the body of the camera feels very fragile, as if you drop it, you can say goodbye to the camera. But it takes formidable images, and it's so sensitive. You can focus on the stars at night, on the back LED camera, screen. So I'm loving it. And it's really, every time I go now to take nightscape photography, I bring both my Canon and my Sony, but I've really only been used my Sony camera for the last couple of years.
Okay. Well, that brings me to my question that I wanted to ask. So these nightscapes, they have the background stars and the foreground landscape. They're not taken in different places in different times, is the stars that you see behind the landscape, are they accurate to that location, or are they just being photoshopped together from two different exposure runs?
Yes. So in my case, every single night landscape photography that I've published, it's not a composite in the sense of what you're saying. You take the landscape at one time or at certain condition, and then the stars and another, and then you blend them together. None of them are, except about two or three that I can remember.
Oh, that makes them even more extraordinary then.
Well, it's how I like doing it. Now, I will tell you, because sometimes people have told, like you post something on social media, and there's always somebody who wants to, write some happy comments about it and go like, oh, that's Photoshop or that's composite. And I'm like, well, it's not. But because what I do is I do take, what we would call a single shot. But when I do the editing, the processing, I do process land and sky separately. Almost every single time. So they all come, it's not a composite. Again, I have over 1,000 night landscape photographies, and I'm telling you that I know two or three are composites and the other are not. But I do edit, those two elements separately, because to me, they, that's how I can bring them to a contrast that I like, where, this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I just want to say the dynamic range, then it must be a real issue, or like what we were talking about with the Orion Nebula again, because the landscape would be very bright compared to very dim stars. Is that a function of the quality of the Sony A7S camera you're using, or?
The thing is that sometimes it's actually the opposite. The sky will be bright and the landscape will be dark. It really depends on the situation. If you are shooting at a Milky Way with some mountains in the foreground and there's absolutely no moon, no lights, your challenge is going to be able to bring up the landscape, because it's going to be really, really dark unless there's some sort of light.
I wouldn't have thought that. Interesting.
Yeah, and so the A7S that you're using, so you sacrificed resolution to get bigger pixels and sensitivity then, because that's only 11 megapixels across the same size sensor as your, whatever the other one is, 34 or 36, right?
Yeah, that's true. But to me, you weigh the pros and cons, and it's just so fun to use. I mean, for me, at least. Again, and I will repeat it, because for me, that's, one thing that I actually don't like at all is, the body being so I don't want to say clumsy, but, really fragile type of looking. Right. It's not a sturdy type of camera. But other than that, I definitely love it.
And you're using a full frame CCD as well, right?
Yes. The SBIG STL 11,000.
So those are big, I think like 9 micron pixels. So you have very sensitive chips. Let's talk about the CCD, like the differences, because that's obviously a much more complex system. I mean, when I shoot landscapes, I'm usually doing it off the hood of my car, for Milky Way or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it really doesn't take much. You can do a long exposure. If you're shooting at short focal length, you don't even have to track. And so with the deep space things, I mean, you're talking about, you said one of those was 49 panels. So for people that don't know, what that means is that's 49 images all tracked of a very specific area of the sky. And these 49 images are taken individually and then combined afterward, piece by piece, so that it creates one huge image, so that you can get the entire Orion constellation or whatever it is in the sky that you're trying to shoot on a much, much wider scale. But to do that, I guess to cut down on time, you had a creative solution.
Do you think I did?
Well, I mean, you're not, you have two identical systems, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, that's what you mean. Yeah, that's true. That's correct.
And how does that work?
Well, yeah. So what you're referring is that basically, as opposed to shooting one camera and one telescope, I have two telescopes in parallel shooting at the same time with two cameras, basically the same identical system twice. And yeah, and that definitely, I mean, that saves me half of the time. It helped me double the time, you know, the acquisition time that I do on a single night. When I go out to image with my friends, you know, maybe we have a five hour window. And then when we're done, I'm like, well, I'm going home with 10 hours, guys. And then, you know, then I get them to love me a little more.
Right. So have you seen this, Tony?
Do you know? No, I haven't. No. So, is it? I just want to ask real quick while we're on that subject. Are both systems parallel looking at adjacent areas of the sky, or are they looking at the same area of the sky?
At the very same area. So basically, yeah. And the way that I'm using them most of the time, so my CCD cameras are monochrome, which means I have to take, I have to use a filter wheel with red, green, and blue filters. Plus one of luminance, which tends to help you know save time, actually. So the way that I'm normally using both telescopes is, in one telescope I'm shooting luminance constantly, one sub, then another, and then another, and go on and so on. And while the other telescope is looping through my RGB filter, first is shooting one of R, one of green, one of blue, and so on and so on. So basically, I'm capturing luminance and color at the same time.
Do you ever shoot narrowband?
I only shoot H-alpha out of all the narrowband, you know, commonly used filters, mm-hmm. for two reasons. One is because that's the only filter that I own.
that'll do it.
but that also comes out of an interest because I really enjoy the photography that comes out of broadband colors, RGB, but I do use the H alpha for those elements. I mean, for those objects that are, you know, very strong on hydrogen alpha signal. So that helped me boost, you know, RGB type of images. So I use H alpha for that. Then there's sulfur 2 and oxygen 3, which are more used in combination with H alpha. But I don't use those because, again, all my images are on broadband color, and that's what I like. So it's not that I don't like narrowband, but that's what I'm doing right now and what I'm enjoying. So probably will continue for a while.
I guess the downside to that, though, is that the moon and, you know, city lights are a pretty big problem for you then. I mean, you can only shoot when it's a new moon or when you're, you know, pretty far away from the cities.
That's right. Yes. And well, it's something that I got used to. I live in Sunnyvale, Northern California. This is on the San Francisco Bay Area. So, you know, this is a wide area according to the Borel scale. So I can't do anything unless narrowband. Not that great either, but I can't do anything here. I always have to take my car and drive to a place. I don't own any remote place, that I could operate it from home. So I drive away. I feel lucky that even though I live on a white area, in terms of light pollution, within an hour, I can see the Milky Way. Within an hour and a half, I get to fairly, really decent skies, at least in one or on another direction of the sky. Maybe there's one, you know, crappy area, but there's always, and then if you go 2 hours, then, you know, I'm on really, you know, I don't need more. I say anything darker is just for bragging, really. This is right. Great. This right. Is great. So, you know, if it takes 1 hour and a half or 2 hours, I got used to do it. So it became part of my routine. So I do it and I get the goodies that I deserve from doing the drive.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so I agree with you. I really like the RGB images, the red, green, blue images, all the broadband stuff, because the colors are a true color. But 99% of my shooting is actually narrowband. So I do shoot hydrogen alpha, sulfur, and oxygen. And the reason is because I feel like most people, you know, it's easy for us out here in California to get to dark skies relatively easily. But if you look at a dark sky map, the entire east side of the country, basically everything east of the Mississippi, it's a chore. I mean, sometimes you have to leave an entire state to get to decent skies to where you can shoot broadband the way we do here. And so the thinking was, you know, if we can start shooting these things from cities with narrowband, then really it opens the door to a lot more people and try to push this into a simple way of imaging from any backyard in the country instead of just, you know, dark skies like we're kind of spoiled with around here.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yes. And it's not that I don't like narrowband images. I like seeing them. It's just that, you know, I got my, I guess, my style. But absolutely, and you're totally right. I tend to joke, and I hope nobody gets offended by these, and that people in the UK need to leave the country to get to really good skies.
Yeah, it's true.
It's it's probably almost true, and not just for the UK, but for other countries as well. And like you said, some people need to leave their state. And yeah, and they should, you know, that doesn't mean they shouldn't enjoy the hobby. So yeah, I'm not against narrowband. It's more, you know, more describing of my images.
Yeah, people give me so much hell on my Instagram. And you know, it's funny because it's usually, I get a lot of messages from, you know, photographers kind of like yourself, like some top level photographers that even some that you've already named in this that just shoot me messages, just kind of picking at me, you know, saying like, we were talking about style earlier and they're like, oh yeah, your style is, you know, rings around the stars, and, you know, noise reduction to hell and back and all this stuff. And it's like, oh yeah. Don't be jealous right now, you know, but I get a lot of hell for the narrowband as well, because the colors, you know, the signal is so high with narrowband because, I mean, you're shooting a very, very small sliver of an individual color. Like when you talk about, like shooting broadband, you're talking about shooting all of, say, red, the color red. But then hydrogen alpha is an extremely narrow sliver of that. I mean, some of these filters are 3 nanometers of mm-hmm. that. And so you can shoot right through most light pollution and get, you know, extremely high signal. So the images pop, but the colors are off from, you know, true color. And so, you know, people joke about the images being cartoony or whatever it is, but At first, I kind of agreed, and the more I've done it, the more it's really grown on me. And you start to appreciate the detail that comes out in narrowband images that it's just nearly impossible to get without it, especially hydrogen alpha.
Right. Well, narrowband has this magic, right? And it's really amazing that, you know, in the middle of a really light polluted city, you get a bit of a sky, and then you can actually take really, you know, fairly good signal with a lot of contrast because of these narrowband filters. So I guess that's a bit of a wow thing for people, you know, that they can do that.
Another thing about narrowband imaging, though, is that one of the reasons they look different than a broadband image is that the features you're seeing are generally highlighted differently than they would be in a broader band filter. For example, if you could imagine a filter that lets you turn a knob and you could go all the way from blue down through green and into red and then all the way into the infrared. And you could see this with your eye. If let's say you're looking at the Horsehead Nebula, which the Hubble Space Telescope has done this kind of imaging, imagine going all the way from the optical into the infrared. What you would see is actually different, because what's causing these things to glow in these wavelengths is actually different. So the Horsehead would look completely different in one wavelength versus another wavelength. And if you could imagine a filter that lets you tune that back and forth, you would see things come into the field of view and then out. You'd see features pop up and then disappear. And so when you're looking at a narrow band filter, like say oxygen, the very narrow wavelength band is going to only let certain features come through, whereas a broader filter like red would let more features come through. So it's always a trade-off, but Dustin's right. I mean, the payoff is awesome in the amount of signal you get in a very light polluted area. So there's really no other way to do it if you're in downtown New York City, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which we will be very soon. We're doing our New York Times Square shooting again in April. So haven't officially announced that on Instagram yet, but I guess this is that official
announcement. You've just done it. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. We're doing that in April, and it looks like the city's approving it this time. But I wanted to...
Well, that's as opposed to last time where the cops showed up, right?
Yeah, I got thrown out by the counterterrorism squad, but, you know, shit happens.
Oh, wow.
So whatever. Whatever. So... yeah, you know, I actually stole your idea, Rogelio. We've never talked about this, but when I saw your two systems, I was like, that makes a lot of sense. Two telescopes with exactly the same – so exactly the same telescopes with exactly the same cameras riding on top of one mount. So just side by side on one mount pointed at the same thing. So you're doubling your image data. I stole that idea and put two Teleview 127 ISs with two full-frame CCDs behind it. And shot it from here at the store. Me and Travis Burke just sat down one night and shot the horse head in portrait. So it was kind of like a, you know, the cameras turned completely sideways, shot a portrait of him. And it's actually the most shared image I've ever taken. I mean, that thing just kind of exploded across the internet. It was like a million views in a couple of days. Yeah, but it was completely stolen from you.
No. I'll tell you, I wasn't copying anybody, but I don't claim to have invented, you know, and actually I'm sure I have not, you know, the two telescopes in parallel. To me, it was a funny thing because I wasn't planning on having two telescopes together. It's just that, so I'm originally from Spain, so I sometimes I've been traveling to Spain a lot, and there was a time that I was being there very often. So I actually got me a full setup there and a full setup here. You know, same equipment, same camera and everything. But then there was a time that I stopped going there as often. So I'm like, I'm going to bring it back. And then that's when I'm like, what am I going to do? Sell it? No, I'm going to put them together. And I'm definitely taking advantage of, you know, the time saving feature more than anything else.
Right. Yeah, well, I am absolutely going to keep stealing the things you do. And so, yeah, I'm just going to put four systems now and tell everybody it was my idea.
Right.
Well, only someone who sells telescopes could do that.
I'm going to be like, Rogelio who?
Go for six.
Yeah, what is this? I got 10. Well, tell me about the mount for this. How do you drive these parallel systems?
The mount that I use is the Takahashi EM400. It's not the most popular of the bunch, at least not in the circles that I move. Most people tend to have, you know, astrophysics, higher, and, you know, Paramount and whatnot. But this came from a suggestion that I received when I was truly starting. This is 2008, and I went onto an astrophotography forum. And I said, I want to get into astrophotography, and I have $10,000. Can you recommend me what to buy? I mean, that's me. You understand? This was my super very beginnings. And then, by the way, I got a lot of criticism. Well, you're crazy. You're going to spend $10,000. You still don't know if you're going to like it. But, you know, one person actually answered the question. And he said, well, I would spend at least 70% on the mount, which to
that's
me
good
was
advice.
Like, yeah. And to me was like, what? Right? It's like, you know, the camera, the telescope, hello. And but yeah, it makes all the sense in the world because, you know, the best camera and best telescope in the world on a crappy mount is not going to get you anything. Whereas, nope. You know, a good mount and an okay camera and okay telescope, well, at least you'll get something. So, and then at that moment, there was this guy who just put his EM400 for sale for $7,000. And I'm like, well, 10,000, 70%, 70. So I went for it. But it's the mount that I'm still using. So I've changed telescopes, I've changed cameras. It holds the load that I put on it without a sweat. I got to know it. So as long as I don't either go into a permanent observatory, which I don't think this mount will be as good as others, or unless I add more weight, which I don't think so, it's still, you know, my power horse. It does what I wanted to do, and it does it marvelously.
I hope you guys listen to that. That is such great advice, because a mount that treats you well, that makes your night at the telescope easy, will pay itself back in so many ways. So it'll make your experience a lot better. I heard earlier in the podcast, you refer to your camera, I don't know if it was the Canon or the Sony, as a her or a she, but eventually you're going to feel that way about your mount as well, because it's that important as far as making good images, I think.
So. It is, yes, absolutely.
Well, you spend a lot of time with this equipment. You know, all astrophotographers do. You get very attached to it. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. So I got my FSQ, the Takahashi FSQ. These are the telescopes that I still have, bought two of them. I got this like in 2008, the end of 2008. Yeah, actually, that's when I got it, December 2008. And then, you know, the dark voices that try to put you down started telling me, oh, yeah, you're doing wide field. That's easy. It gets really tough when you get into bigger focal length. You know, kind of like downplaying what I was doing. You know, wide field, that's easy. But here's what happened is that I started loving, I mean, I loved, you know, the fact that I could get my, you know, set up my, you know, all my gear, you know, up on a mountaintop, within half hour, start rolling in another half hour, get, you know, good data without sweating. You know, I don't have to worry about collimation. I don't have to worry, you know, about all the things. You know, I don't need the guiding to be extremely precise because I'm shooting sort of wide, you know, short focal length. And I got excited about what I was doing, and I wanted to get bigger and bigger. So, you know, people were telling me that's not how the learning curve goes. The learning curve is about getting onto higher focal length. And I stay on the same, you know, 400 millimeter focal length for all these years. And I enjoyed every second of it. So, you know, that goes to those who told me. Yeah. And then people say, and then you got, you know, really good at it, which I guess is what happens if you keep doing something, you know, for a long time and, you know, you keep challenging yourself. So, yeah, so I love wide field, and I'm still doing it. Doesn't mean that I wouldn't like to get longer focal length. It's something that actually, because I haven't done much of it, it's a challenge, but not something that I want to do, you know, loading it on my trunk and drive to some places. That would have to be in a different way.
Well, we need to get you logged into the OPT remote observatories. You know, we have like a 17-inch plane wave in one and a lot of long focal length scopes. Actually, we just got in the first Takahashi RC FRC 300 ever made, serial number 001. So everybody here is kind of like freaking out about it, you know, but we're putting that one in an observatory as well. But we need to get you logged in and let you play with some of the longer focal length stuff and just... Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
you do.
Yeah. I think it'd be amazing to see, you know, because, yeah, I mean, putting panel or big mosaics together with something like that would be absurd. Yeah. Know, just how much detail would be coming out.
I dream about certain objects, you know, at a long focal length that they've been imaged, you know, beautifully already. But I'm like, no, but let's go deeper. You know, because people have focus on the details, which is what you get, you know, usually when you're doing longer focal length. And I'm like, yeah, but you can get details and you can go deeper and deeper and deeper. And, you know, that's that's one of the things that drives me as well. You know, hey, I've seen this object. Can we get deeper? I know there's some stuff there, you know, get a different view or something new, or, you know, at least the challenge is exciting.
Well, before we run out of time, I just want to ask you one more question. And that has to do with the fact that your images have been everywhere, as we've talked about at the top of the podcast, from Astronomy Magazine, it's been on the BBC, National Geographic. I read on the internet that some of your images have even been in the remake of Cosmos. What is that like? How does that, I mean, tell us a story about how that, something like that might happen. How do you get your...
Well, I was as shocked as you. So that's my short answer. I was contacted, and I once remembered the name, and I think I remember, but I don't want to get it wrong, so I won't say it. By somebody, and if I get this right, it was from the, you know, Hubble Heritage team that processed the Hubble images, and telling, you know, contact me, hey, we're doing they didn't say a remake of Cosmos. They did. It was described as an astronomy TV program or something. It wasn't, you know, they didn't give me that clue. And they were asking to use an image that I had of Orion, but this was before my whole Orion constellation image. So this image was one that I took in 2008. It wasn't, honestly, it really wasn't that good. And if I dig out and share it with you, you would agree. And they wanted to use that image to basically create, use it as part of a flyby that they were going to do in the movie. I'm mistaking with the Hubble 3D movie. I'm sorry. I'm telling you a different story.
That's all you right. That's a good story because I think I know who you talked to. You talked to Zolt Levay.
Zolt or Lisa. I don't remember.
Or Lisa. Who. Yeah, Lisa Fattare. Yeah. Those two, I used to work with them at the Institute. Zolt has since retired, but Lisa, I think, is still there.
So. Right. Yeah. No, and this was the story about when they contacted me for the Hubble 3D movie and then they used that Orion picture.
By the way, it was an IMAX movie, wasn't it? The Hubble.
Yeah, and it was. And it was it was really cool to see. You know, I mean, the movie is really amazing. You know, I love to be able to do that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, well, that's really cool. So these people, when they want to use your stuff, whether it's Scientel or National Geographic, they just reach out and say, hey, man, we want to use your stuff.
That's right. Yep. That's what they do. You get an email and, you know, they'll give you whatever details they want to give you. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, once I got a message from Apple, they wanted to use one of my images from Yosemite as, you know, one of their, you know, marketing things. They basically wanted to buy the image, but in the end, it didn't happen. So sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
Wow. So all these astronomy pictures of the day features, and then I don't know. I feel like you kind of arrived when Apple wants to use your stuff on their.
They did not
software.
In that particular case. So.
Well, that's really great. Okay. Well, is there any final advice that you could give us before we sign off here? Somebody looking to get started in astrophotography, what would you say to them now?
I find that, you know, this last moment, you know, last words, tend to try to be like the most meaningful ones. but in my case, there's one thing that we were talking about before about style, and that I wanted to say, which is, you really do whatever you want. Like everybody says, if what you're doing, it's legal, you know, you don't do anything illegal and you don't lie about what you're doing, then you can really do anything you want. But when it comes to your goals, my suggestion is if you can look at things, I mean, this is what I did. So it's easy for me to say, when you look at other people's images, you know, you don't have to want to, you know, do what they're doing. Just try to set your own goals. The way that I do my images is I'm going to do this object and then I'm going to see how good it comes out. Before I go for it, I set a goal. I want it to look, you know, this good or that good. And many times I don't reach that goal, but I'm very goal oriented as opposed to I'm just going to do this object and I'm going to, you know, throw hours and this. You do the planning, but I also, you know, I also try to picture what is it that I want. And then if I need something, if I fall short, like, oh, I should have got more data, then I go and get more data. Or I'm not really good at, you know, some part of the processing, I don't know how to do this, then I try to learn how to do that. Oh, I want this view and it takes me 49 panes, you know, different panes on a mosaic, as opposed to just, you know, spending a couple of nights. Then I'm gonna spend that time. So I think if you can find that kind of drive in yourself of I'm going to set a goal for an image and I'm going to try to reach that goal. And if your goal is simple, then, you know, you stay wherever you want to stay. But I guess, you know, that's one thing that I don't see many people do, you know, setting a specific goal or a vision of what they want to do on the next picture. So, you know, you have that. And then if you accomplish it, great. And if not, that's fine. It's also a learning experience. And, you know, maybe it still looks really great. So.
Wow. So you already, that sounds like how an artist might approach a painting. You already have something in your mind's eye of what you're trying to accomplish before you even start.
Yeah, I do that. But then I don't try to drive the image. You know, I don't force the image. I mean, the image is going to, I don't want to sound too corny, but the image needs to talk to me. I'm not going to force the image to, you know, to look like something that is not. But, you know, because you have so many references out there about, you know, what's out there, you can have a picture. Like, for example, when I did the CMIS 147, this is a supernova remnant. It's huge and really faint. You know, I picture, I need to make it so that, you know, it really stands out. And if I can get some background dust, you know, let's go for that. So, you know, I did, you know, I took my data so that I could try to achieve that goal. And then, you know, I did my processing also with that goal in mind, and it kind of like came out like that. So yeah, it's a bit of the way you would approach a painting, except that, you know, you still work with data that comes to you. You don't have, you know, again, you can do whatever you want, but I do set my own limits when it comes to that.
Dustin, do you have anything to add before we go?
No. I've got a lot to think about. That, you know, pushing images in that way is really what excites me. And seeing this stuff come out, I always look forward to seeing the new images. And I've been pushing things, like for me, it's been about time recently. Like I want to see exactly what you were mentioning a second ago, which is like, how deep can you go on an image? You know, I just did 90 hours on the Helix and still processing it. I mean, it's got a lot to do, but it's fun to take images that I've seen before and just put a ton of time into them and see how much is actually there. Like how much can you pull out of something? And so that's kind of been the idea, but I really like your approaching it more like you would landscape photography, which is find the view and then go after that view regardless of what it takes as far as panels or, you know, time or whatever, and just create that. I think that, yeah, you're right. More people should be doing that because that's how you do regular photography. And that's a fantastic approach to this type as well.
Right. One example that I like using, and I know we're short of time, it's like if you go to Paris and you take a picture of the Eiffel Tower, you could take, you know, a picture that is extremely beautiful for you. You took it. But it's absolutely not memorable for anybody but yourself because you took it. It tells nothing to nobody. But if you find maybe an interesting angle to take the picture, or maybe with a tree in front, or with some light effect, or with the moon behind if it happens to be, or something else, then you start to make the picture more memorable, right? And that's what I sometimes, again, it's not so deliberate that I try to make a picture memorable, but I definitely try to identify things that will make a difference so that then I'm more motivated to go for it. I'm chasing a view that I haven't seen and I want to see it, period. That's my drive.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed our little podcast today. This was a great deep dive into astrophotography. I was having a lot of fun. This was great. So thank you so much. Our guest today was Rogelio Bernal Andreo, and he is – you got to go check out his stuff, folks. Go to deepskycolors.com. Look at his Flickr tweet. Are you on – you got to be on Instagram too, right?
Yes, Deep Sky Colors, same thing.
Okay, so there you go. All right, so I guess, well, we did another one, Dustin. This has been a great podcast. Thanks for bringing Rogelio to us.
Yeah, and Rogelio, I know we got plans to do some big stuff soon, and I'm sure that we'll get you back on here to talk about some of that. So exciting stuff. Thank you again for coming on.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you, and yeah, let's do it again whenever you want to.
I can't wait. Okay. Well, thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, keep looking up. Space Junk was produced by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California, in partnership with Deep Astronomy. Please send feedback and questions to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.